Hello? I know you're there. Look, I can see the lights of the TV. Please, I just want to watch the finale. Come on, guys. I'll give you a foot massage or anything.
Time to get your own fiber? Speak to Vox. Because for a limited time period, you can save up to 3,000 Rand in installation costs. And we'll send a technician to help you get set up.
Hello?
Go to vox.co.za. Get fiber to your home. Get free installation and activation. Open the door to endless entertainment.
T's and C's apply.
Bitco is revolutionizing the way businesses connect. We're taking on your connectivity challenges and shooting our high-speed fiber internet across the country. Not just for some, but for everyone. Fiber is not a luxury, but a necessity. For business, for life, for you. And being connected is everything. So network with a Tier 1 internet provider and take your business to the next level of connectivity. Bitco.co.za. Connectivity is everything.
I'm Duncan MacLeod, and you're listening to the Tech Central podcast. I'm on an internet call now to Canada to talk to none other than Steve Song, who I don't think needs too much introduction to readers of Tech Central. Steve is, of course, founder of Village Telco, which builds low-cost mesh networking technologies for use in underserviced areas. He's also the developer of the Undersea Africa Undersea Cables map, which shows the submarine cable systems that connect to the continent. That map has changed dramatically in the last 10 years. We'll talk to him a bit about that today. Steve was also a fellow of the Shuttleworth Foundation for 3 years, where he worked on telecoms and access issues in South Africa. Prior to that, he was with the International Development Research Center in Ottawa for 10 years, focusing on funding and engaging in research and ICT development, mostly related to Africa. So it's fair to say that he has enormous experience in and knowledge of policy and regulatory issues pertaining to the ICT sector. And I'm super pleased to have him on the podcast for the first time for a wide-ranging chat. Steve, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Duncan. Looking forward to it.
We are broadcasting the show live today on live.techcentral.co.za. If you have any comments on what we're chatting about today or any questions you'd like to ask Steve, please do send a WhatsApp message, preferably as a voice note if you can, to 071-999-1111, and we'll include it in the show today. That number again, and please add it to your phone for future shows. That's 071-999-1111. So, Steve, let me start by asking you what you've been up to these last few years. What's keeping you busy these days?
What I'm working most on these days is regulation and looking at how regulation can empower small-scale operators, whether small-scale commercial operators or community operators. I think the conclusion I've come to over the last 10 years is that regulation is one of the key enablers of affordable access, and that regulators, you know, get their attention focused on large operators because large operators have the resources to capture their attention. And my goal at the moment is to reclaim some of that that attention from the regulators on smaller operators.
Okay. You're based in Canada now. Do you still travel quite a lot to the southern tip of Africa?
Yeah. No, I was I was there only last week. Yes, I have an odd job that I'm based in Nova Scotia, Canada, but most of my work is in sub-Saharan Africa. My carbon footprint is not the most attractive thing.
All right. So you spend a good chunk of your time down here still. Were you born in Canada, Steve?
I was born born in Canada, although I spent some of my early childhood in South Africa. South African father.
Oh right, okay. That's where the connection comes in. So you grew up in Canada. You went to school there. What did you study?
I studied cognitive science and artificial intelligence, but
wow,
never used it in a. In a professional capacity.
Okay. You must be quite fascinated then with all the developments in AI in the recent past, with some of the work that companies like Google are doing.
I am. Although, I think my early studies, you know, gave me a healthy skepticism as to, you know, exactly how far artificial intelligence can go. I think we kind of misnamed the field a little bit by using words like intelligence and learning, which are uniquely human words, to describe what computers do.
Okay. You don't think we're seeing massive advances now in AI that are going to lead to artificial intelligences and the ability for us to interact with computers in the way we do with humans?
I think we're going to, I mean, I think there are some remarkable things going on now with machine learning. But in very, very narrow ways. So, you know, we will see amazing achievements in the ability of machines to do very, very specific things. But in terms of actually achieving anything like human intelligence, I'm not too worried about that happening any time in the near future.
Possibly not in our lifetimes. So, Steve, let's delve into some issues that I know you care a great deal about and are quite passionate about. And I know one of those is radio frequency spectrum. There's been a lot of attention on radio frequency spectrum in South Africa in the last little while. A lot of noise, if I could call it that, with government wanting to create a wholesale open access network and possibly reserve a big chunk of 4G and future 5G spectrum for that WOAN entity. A lot has been said about the WOAN from all sides. You're a bit of an external observer of what's happening here. Vodacom and MTN, of course, have argued strongly against the WOAN concept, and they say that it would be a bad precedent for the WOAN to become dominant and to get the bulk of 4G spectrum. Telkom and Cell C seem more keen on the idea. As an independent observer, if you like, what is your take on what government is trying to do in the South African context? And do you think the WOAN is a good idea or not?
I think the WOAN is a good idea in the sense that it attempts to address what I think is a kind of growing crisis in the way spectrum is assigned, and that as the demand for spectrum has increased, the sort of dominant model for assigning spectrum, which is the auction, I think is leading to some negative outcomes for portable access for everyone. So if you're paying $20, $30, $40, $50 million for a spectrum license, ultimately those costs are going to be passed on to the consumer. And the evidence from research seems to point that way, that, you know, high fees paid at auction for spectrum leads to reduced rollout, higher consumer costs. So as a strategy in a country where affordable access for all is a priority, auctions may not be the smartest approach, although they are the kind of default now. Mm. So I like the idea of exploring alternatives. It seems extreme to me that that the government would have decided to, you know, take all of the available spectrum and put it into a WOAN. I think from a risk management point of view, that seems you know, not the wisest approach, in that, you know, wholesale wireless networks have not been tried widely around the world. So betting everything on them is kind of a risky move. I think what ICASA originally intended to do in setting aside a portion of the available spectrum for a wholesale network, which I think it wasn't said explicitly by ICASA, but I think that was their intention, seems like a more prudent course of action.
All right. Okay. So, I mean, certainly if you listen to the big operators, they argue that they've got the balance sheets to build the networks. They say that, you know, the smaller players in the industry, the guys who want to get into the industry, including some internet service providers, simply don't have the balance sheets to be able to compete, to raise the money to build networks of national scope like they do. And they therefore argue that they should be getting exclusive use spectrum because they have the balance sheets and the proven ability to roll out these networks. Do they have a fair point there?
Well, that's the old story, right? You know, that the large network operators, you know, periodically trot out. And I think there was an element of truth to that. But I think the game has changed now. And fiber and the spread of fiber optic networks has changed the state of play and opened up new possibilities for smaller players to deliver into niche markets, whether those are niche verticals or niche geographies. You know, once you're on, you know, fiber, you're only milliseconds from the living beating heart of the internet. So why wouldn't you be able to compete? And that's, you know, I think we're seeing that with the spread of Wi-Fi now. Because, you know, if you have a fiber network, you're simply leaving money on the table by not sort of deploying Wi-Fi everywhere you have fiber. And, you know, the its spread, I think, is sort of testament to, you know, the value that you can create with a little bit of spectrum and access to fiber networks. So I think that that used to be true. Mm-hmm. I mean, to become a network operator, you had to work out, you know, how to do international backhaul. You know, 10 years ago, it was mostly via satellite. You know, to build national backhaul networks, the middle mile, the last mile. Now it's becoming disaggregated, and we need a regulatory environment that actually recognizes that disaggregation and empowers the kind of more niche operators.
And that's going to change more with the advent of 5G, isn't it? I mean, 5G uses, at least at first, it's going to use millimeter wave spectrum. That's going to mean a massive densification of the network, and it is those last mile fiber providers that are in a strong position. I was listening to a presentation from Alfonso Samuels, who's the CEO of Telkom's wholesale division, OpenServe, yesterday, and he said that they are in a particularly strong position when it comes to 5G, because you know, they are going to be antennas or base stations, whatever you want to call them, mounted on just about every street pole. I was also chatting to Niels Schumann, the former CEO of Vumatel, who said that they are also in a very, very strong position through this fiber infrastructure that they've deployed through the suburbs and through the cities in South Africa, because 5G is really going to require that that level of dense fiber, and the densification of the mobile infrastructure is putting them in a very strong position. But does 5G change the game entirely? Are we going to see the emergence of local ISPs like we do in the traditional ISP market? Is 5G going to democratize mobile communications?
There's a lot baked into that one. I mean, to start with, I think 5G is one of the most unhelpful terms invented for telecoms in the last 2 years. It sort of implies that, you know, it's a leap forward in the way that 3G was a leap forward from 2G and 4G from 3G. But it really is not, you know, it's not the kind of step change that you saw between LTE and 3G, you know, which was a movement to more efficient use of spectrum and also old digital platforms. 5G is a kind of aggregation of different technologies. Millimeter wave is one of them. Mm. You know, I think it's going to have its biggest impact in urban areas, which in some ways makes it least interesting for me, in terms of my priorities.
Sure.
I think, you know, there's going to be some interesting things that play out there in that from a millimeter wave perspective, you know, there is a move to auctioning those bands. But as you get up that high in frequencies, and especially if you're doing kind of these, you know, point-to-point urban links that are only a few hundred meters, the chances of creating interference in those spaces between operators are very, very tiny, because the beams are so narrow for this technology. So there's also unlicensed spectrum in those frequencies. And I think, you know, my prediction is that what we will see is unlicensed spectrum in the millimeter wave gaining ground dramatically simply because, you know, it's the technology that people can use and don't have to wait for it to go to auction. I think, you know, from the point of view of benefiting the most people and in the most egalitarian way, you know, 5G is not necessarily going to be the technology that I would focus on. You know, it has incremental gains in terms of latency. There's this notion of kind of network slicing where you can create you know, specific kind of niche kinds of service technologies for operators. I think there's an attempt, and you know, this is my slightly biased point of view. I think there's an attempt to sort of use 5G to as a means of kind of corralling spectrum and attention to the incumbent operators. When I think that, you know, more of a focus on a variety of access technologies from you know, expanding Wi-Fi to dynamic spectrum to looking at unlicensed bands and the millimeter waves, that you by taking a more diverse approach to spectrum assignment, we're going to enable more competition and less kind of, you know, just battling it out between the big incumbents in the market.
So what should we've had this WOAN debate here in South Africa for some time now, and I think everyone's aired their views from the various sides of it. But what, from your perspective, would you like to see policymakers and the regulator here in South Africa doing differently, perhaps things they haven't considered yet, to help expand coverage to more people and to improve speeds and bridge the so-called digital divide? What more do you think our policymakers and regulators could be doing?
A couple of things. I mean, one would be to make market permeability an explicit policy agenda. So, you know, within other parts of South African government policy, you know, supporting SMMEs is an explicit policy agenda, yet it isn't really reflected within the ECA or within a lot of ICASA regulations. So enabling small-scale operators, I think, will create a much healthier environment. You know, in the same way that, you know, when you, you know, if you want a healthy forest, right, you don't just want a bunch of big trees. You know, you want saplings and a diverse ecosystem. So more practically and more specifically, from a regulatory point of view, I would look specifically at regulations that could empower, you know, new market entrants. So, for instance, getting rid of fees below a certain turnover, right? So allowing, you know, creating that space. You know, if you plant a sapling in the forest, you protect it for a little while to allow it to get its roots to grow. The same thing, we want to create the same space for new operators to be able to prove their business models and their cases. ICASA has done a fantastic job in terms of reducing specific spectrum fees, you know, particularly for point-to-point use, but also for rural use. So that is somewhere where ICASA is actually leading. But looking at that ecosystem and saying, you know, how can we create a little, you know, a space for smaller operators to have the time to grow into, you know, more robust entities. And I think the other piece of that is to look at fiber networks in the country. I mean, I think, you know, in South Africa, it's similar to most countries in the region where it's often more expensive to get to the coast than it is to get internationally. And so looking at how the government can play a role in driving down the cost of access to national fiber networks. Now, you know, obviously that's been tried in a way with broadband InfraCo, but there hasn't been an approach that has addressed the issue of pricing. Typically, state-financed or state-owned networks will build networks, but then they'll just engage in kind of price following with the private sector. And that doesn't solve the problem. It just creates a kind of, you know, a parallel network that isn't sort of stimulating access. I think one principle that is kind of missing from the debate is this notion of the commons, that there are particular parts of infrastructure where the actual use of the infrastructure becomes more important than recovering the cost of its deployment. Like when you build a road, you know, you don't think about how quickly, how many tolls must I set up and how quickly must I recoup, the cost of building the road. You know, from an economic perspective, your goal is really to stimulate traffic on that network because of the positive externalities that are generated as a result of all that traffic. And I think we need strategies that kind of embody that to create fiber, you know, as a kind of platform for economic growth. And that's going to take a different approach, which is more of a cost-based approach than a kind of commodity approach.
That's interesting. So are you proposing that there be some sort of price regulation in the wholesale context?
Yeah, I think price regulation, is a dangerous, maybe not dangerous, but you know, it can lead to negative outcomes in that when one sort of arbitrarily imagines what the right price is. I think exploring a commons-based approach where contributors to a commons-based network can actually, you know, are compensated for the infrastructure that they bring to the network, but that the costs are simply based on what it costs to invest in and operate the network. So an example of that would be Tenet in South Africa. Mm-hmm. Tenet operates fiber infrastructure to serve, university and research institutions across the country, and it recovers the costs of doing that no more. From a strategic point of view, this is a great idea because, you know, universities need to have the cheapest possible bandwidth in order to create a platform for the kind of research, innovation, learning that goes on there. And I think, you know, that a similar principle is true for countries now. It is the platform that is going to enable, social and economic development.
We've seen a lot of focus on open access principles, and some fiber operators have quite keenly adopted it. I'm thinking specifically of players like Dark Fiber Africa, Vumatel, and others. And how does the open access model differ from the kind of proposal that you'd like to see here to bring down those national fiber costs?
Well, open access is a term claimed by many, and it generally refers to free and fair access to fiber infrastructure. It doesn't say anything about pricing, really, in that all pricing is negotiated, you know, on a kind of bilateral basis between the operator and the consumer. So, I mean, it's not a very strong term. I mean, it generally means you're being fair as an operator and not deliberately excluding people. A commons-based approach would actually say, look, you know, all of this, fiber is a tide that raises all ships in South Africa, all operators, and if we contribute it to it collectively and recoup our costs in a way that, you know, that is fair to all of the contributors, then we could focus on the positive externalities which accrue to the growth of fiber networks and less on trying to compete with each other on it. And I think that's the key thing, is that, fiber is a very different technology from spectrum in that its capacity is relatively infinite, right? You know, even if you saturate a fiber connection by changing the terminating equipment, you can increase its capacity again. Terrestrial networks in particular, you know, where you're seeing 96 strands of fiber deployed in a single sort of trenching of fiber, or even 192, we're getting to capacities where we're not touching, you know, it's kind of a non-rival resource in that it's difficult to see any operator excluding another operator based on their use of fiber capacity in the, you know, in the near future.
So, Steve, you've changing tack slightly. You've put out a number of posts on your blog and elsewhere, and we've picked them up on Tech Central as well, where you've made some very interesting proposals, saying that the mobile operators should consider, or perhaps even be forced to make their 2G data carrier available free of charge. In other words, GPRS, the old GPRS and Edge. We know how slow they are. But you've made proposals that the operators, in fact, make that access available free of charge, and then if consumers want faster access to the mobile networks, they then pay for access to the 3G and 4G networks. Just walk us through what your thinking is there and the impact you believe it could potentially have on connectivity and again, bridging the digital divide, specifically in the South African context.
Sure. Well, what brought me there actually was the network neutrality debate as it applied to zero rating of services. So, and a debate that blew up quite spectacularly in India between Facebook and their Free Basics operating and civil society organizations that argued that that zero rating content in a kind of walled garden was bad for innovation, bad for India. And I felt conflicted by the debate, because on the one hand I agree. I think creating Facebook as a default is especially given, you know, the lack of transparency around the algorithmic manipulation of news and things like that is just, you know, it's a very dangerous thing to do. At the same time, I love the fact that Facebook actually get the fact that affordability is one of the fundamental blockers to the use of the internet by the poor. So, you know, I was sort of torn in two directions there on this issue, and it seemed to me that, well, you know, couldn't you have the best of both worlds simply by zero rating everything at a basic speed? And, you know, it occurred to me then that, well, actually, that's how mobile phones scaled on the continent. That, you know, the original, when mobile phones were first launched in 1994 in South Africa, and they came with a monthly fee. It was a business decision to scrap the monthly fee for mobile phones that led to their massive scaling. So you could actually have a mobile phone and pay nothing and still be on the network, but you were adding value to the network operator by extending its network effects, that you were another person who was dialable on the network. So it was in the interests of mobile network operators to pay the costs of keeping everybody registered on the network. And it seemed to me that value exists in the same way for mobile network operators now with data. In that, you know, if you're an advertiser, if you're reaching, you know, only kind of 30% of the market, but, you know, there's data coverage of, you know, 70, 80, 90% of the market, then, you know, in a sort of twist of the dial, you could extend your addressable market. And it's good for governments in that, you know, from the point of view of, you know, the desire to switch to more electronic government services is more efficient, having a sort of universal basic internet would instantly extend the reach of those kinds of services and create more of an incentive to invest in them. It would also be great for apps, app developers. You know, we see a lot of app bloat, you know, and, you know, you have to download, an app that takes, 40 or 50 megs. if there was a universal basic internet, there would be a huge incentive to write to design apps that were very, very parsimonious in their use of data. And I think the another key issue is that this is a very, very high value app for, or you know, strategy for the poor who are going to use tools like WhatsApp, Telegram, WeChat, and others as, you know, fundamental social and economic enablers that help them get stuff done. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, the spread of messaging services is proof of that. But maybe the most important point here, and this is for mobile network operators, is that, I mean, they're on a burning platform. Voice and SMS revenues are steadily decreasing and will, you know, ultimately evaporate as users move to all IP-based services, whether it's Netflix or WhatsApp or, you know, Skype. It doesn't matter. You know, we are moving to an all IP world. And from a strategic point of view, it only makes sense for a mobile network operator to have as many data customers as possible to begin to prop up declining revenues from voice and SMS. Now, that's painful, but ultimately, you know, that's where the puck is going to be, you know, as Wayne Gretzky would say. Apologies for the Canadian metaphor there.
No
but,
worries.
if you look at companies like Reliance Jio, in India, that are effectively offering universal basic internet. You know, it's cost almost nothing to have basic internet access on their networks, and they've built an all IP based network. That's the future. So strategically, you know, if I were a big network operator, I would want to be gathering as many data customers as possible. And also in terms of onboarding people who may not be familiar with the internet or find value in the internet, creating a universal basic internet is a great way to allow them the freedom to explore and discover value for themselves. Because it's only when we play around that we figure out, you know, what is valuable to us on the internet. And when your hard-won airtime just sort of, you know, disappears in the space of 30 minutes and you have no idea where it went, then your incentive to actually play around and discover value is very, very low. It's just like, you know, don't use the airtime. So I think, there's just a million reasons why this is a good idea. And I think, you know, it would be great to see a network operators adopt it. But I think the regulators, governments could be doing things like, you know, de-risking it as a strategy for operators. Like, for instance, indemnifying an operator against losses if they agree to turn on universal basic internet. There are technical... Sorry, carry on.
Sorry, Steve, are there any downsides to it, though? I mean, if this was available to everybody, can the network cope with the volume of traffic that will be flowing across it?
There are bound to be technical issues in terms of coping with it. I understand that from the implementation of Free Basics that there have been, you know, sort of technical impacts of that happening. I think those impacts, I think, are fairly low for South Africa, which has extensive 3G and 4G infrastructure. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I say turning on, 2G-like speeds, I'm not talking literally about 2G networks, but I'm talking about 64 kilobits per second, right? And 64 kilobits per second as a percentage of a 3G or 4G network is tiny. I think, you know, if you go into regions 2G only, and you get a lot of people on the network, you could create issues for the network. But I think in South Africa, those areas are relatively small, and in areas where that are not very populated. So, and I think as an issue, it only decreases as the capacity of the network, gets larger and larger, you know, in the transition from 3G to 4G networks, because as a percentage of the total capacity of the network, it becomes an increasingly small percentage. I honestly cannot see a downside to this. I mean, yeah.
have you floated
you know, the... I'd love to hear...
Sorry, Steve. Have you floated the idea with any of the operators? And if you have, what has their response been? And also, are you aware of any operators anywhere in the world that have tried this?
Let me answer the second one first. There are lots of operators around the world that are offering sort of variations on a theme of universal basic internet. So they'll do things that, you know, a bit like, you know, what happens with ADSL accounts and with many service providers in South Africa is that once you exhaust your cap, you drop down to a basic speed. And many mobile network operators in the Philippines, in Peru, I think in the Emirates States have that kind of offering where you have to buy a bundle, but once you exhaust your bundle, your minimum basic speed never drops below 64 kilobits per second. And, you know, it's just a smart play by the operator because it keeps them as an addressable digital customer on the network. And, encourages them to re-top up on that network. And as I mentioned, Reliance Jio in India effectively offers that, so I haven't spoken to any operators in South Africa directly about this, other than publishing stuff in the press. I know that a colleague of mine, Christoph Stork, is a researcher in ICTs, has approached operators in Namibia with this and elsewhere. I think the pushback has been that there's not enough value to them to implement it as a strategy. Which, ultimately I have to disagree with. Maybe not enough short-term value, but long-term, whoever gets the most data customers wins in the end.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. At the Telkom annual results presentation yesterday, the CEO said that they are actively thinking about switching off their 2G network so that they can refarm that spectrum or reallocate that spectrum for 3G and 4G. I think Telkom is in a bit of a unique position in being able to do that. I think MTN and Vodacom and Cell C as well, for that matter, still have a very large base of 2G customers, so they can't simply switch them off. But I'm sure that those companies as well would love to be in the position that Telkom is in now, where they are actually in the position to be able to say, well, we may now think about switching off our 2G network. I suspect the big operators don't want to be encouraging people to use 2G at all.
That's an interesting question. I mean, to emphasize that universal basic internet is not predicated on the existence of 2G networks,
right.
Just 2G-like
Understood.
Speeds.
Yeah.
So 2G networks are still extremely powerful, especially for networks like MTN and Vodacom, because they have great coverage, right? If you want to deliver reliable voice services, 900 megahertz 2G network is the bomb. It's very, very reliable and well understood infrastructure. If you want to move to, if you want to deliver voice, well, 3G is no good for voice, obviously. You have to move to LTE, right? And voice over LTE, while it's been deployed in a variety of areas, it still appears to be, if I can use the technical term, a little janky. You know, so you know, if you're MTN or Vodacom, you know, and your business is predicated on being able to deliver a reliable voice services everywhere, then, you know, you're probably not thinking of turning off 2G in a hurry. You'd much rather have more spectrum so you can leave that technology running and never have a question of your voice and networks going down for a while. And then deploy elsewhere. With telecom, it's different because they've never really had that infrastructure, that voice infrastructure. So for them, it's perhaps a no-brainer.
Different kind of operator, more of a data-led proposition from them, whereas the others have built their businesses on voice and broadband came later. But Steve, let's switch tack again a bit and talk about undersea cables. You are very well known for the map you developed, licensed under a Creative Commons license, which keeps up to date with all the current and planned undersea cables around Africa. When you started that map, it looked rather different to how it looks today. Please tell me why you started that map, the impact it's had, and how it's changed over the years.
I started the map because I couldn't understand all the news announcements. Back in sort of 2008, we started seeing announcements from CECOM, and then Easy, I think, had been sort of under discussion for a few years. And it just wasn't clear to me where the cables were going, who they were going to serve, and how, you know, what went where. So I created a simple map that I think just had basically SAT3, CECOM, and Easy on it. If you'd asked me then, you know, 10 years on, how many cables, you know, I'd be like IBM describing, you know, what's the maximum demand for the number of computers in the world, you know, sort of five or six, you know, because, you know, the investment in undersea capacity just continues to blow my mind. It is a monstrous amount of undersea capacity that continues to be invested in now. So we've got about 13 or 14 undersea cables serving sub-Saharan Africa and another half dozen in the works. There's a sail cable going from Cameroon to Brazil. What kind of sense does that make? What's the economic story there, you know, which I suspect is kind of, you know, more of a kind of Huawei global strategy, but you know, the immediate demand for that kind of capacity simply doesn't exist as far as I can make out. So it's amazing what's going on, because you know, it may not be amazing for every undersea operator, and that some may fail, but in terms of, you know, for African countries, it's just fantastic. And you know, what we've seen as a result of that is just this incredible investment in terrestrial fiber infrastructure. You know, literally hundreds of thousands of kilometers of fiber, terrestrial fiber, now has been invested in as a result of these undersea cables. So it's a pretty incredible story. In fact, I think it's as big a story as mobiles, although, you know, it's not as obvious, right? You don't land at the airport and say, hey, everyone's got a mobile in their hands, right? Yeah. You know, most of the fiber is underground. But I think, you know, in terms of game changer technologies, it's as big as mobile.
And there seems to be a lot of interest now in the transatlantic routes. You just mentioned the Cameroon-Brazil link, but there are a number of other projects that are in development. And again, not all of them are going to come to fruition, but there's at least two, or there may be three now, transatlantic cables between South Africa or Angola and Brazil, linking into cable systems that link to the U.S. Many of these projects are punting the fact that this is going to provide a lower latency route to the US, which is obviously a key market for the internet, where a lot of server infrastructure is based. When do we see the end of this, or does this cable build just continue forever as older cables become too slow, as they start to fail? Does this sort of development that we've seen over the last 10 years continue into the foreseeable future?
I think it's going to get complicated, because most of these cables that have been built to date have been kind of public internet use cables.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, more than 80% of the international capacity of undersea cables is actually being used by, you know, the big five, you know, Google, Facebook, Microsoft, Amazon, Apple, in terms of using it to sort of synchronize their global data infrastructure. And what that is leading to is to these big Silicon Valley companies investing in and building their own fiber networks, undersea cables. And what does that mean for the public internet in terms of international undersea cables? I don't know, but that is an emerging issue, in that there is just this, you know, there's a few gorillas in the room when it comes to undersea cables and capacity that are from a public policy point of view going to emerge as an issue, I think, soon.
Interesting. And of course, a lot of these players, like Netflix, for example, which is one of the biggest users of internet capacity, have established capacity, if you like, in locally here in Johannesburg and in Cape Town, in places like NAP Africa, for example. And so when I'm watching a show on Netflix, I'm almost certainly watching it from a server sitting in Johannesburg, not connecting to any of these undersea cables. And I'd imagine that must have an impact on the business case as well, as more and more of these international content providers put down CDNs, or content delivery networks, in country. I suppose the demand for capacity on those undersea cables, certainly from consumers, becomes less.
I think it mitigates it, but I think there's still steadily increasing demand. You know, Netflix has got to refresh those caches, you know, on a regular basis, and
right.
And you do get efficiencies from CDNs, and they are strategically hugely important. But I mean, I don't think that's going to interfere with the growth of sort of international undersea capacity.
Okay. Steve, let's talk a bit about transparency in the telecom sector. I know you recently wrote on this subject. Why is transparency important, and what do you mean by it?
So what I mean is public access to information about telecommunications infrastructure, and that includes fiber networks, towers, spectrum, even sort of pricing on backhaul networks. And the reason I think it's important is twofold. One is that, you know, there's a lot of money in telecoms, and transparency on how investments happen, how, you know, a sector which is, you know, constitutes a significant portion of value for economies, you know, it deserves more transparency. But, you know, perhaps more closer to home for me is the issue of, is how do we connect everybody? Right. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, what's happened is that the value of being connected to the internet has reached the point where it's no longer a legitimate national strategy to say we're going to connect 80% of the population.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think, you know, we have to, and from an egalitarian perspective, we have to connect everybody. And that the large network operators, which have, you know, delivered tremendous value in connecting a lot of people, is not the model that is going to connect everybody. I mean, I think of it like a, you know, if you think of a glass mason jar, right, and you're filling it with kind of fist-sized stones, you know, you can fill up that jar, and it looks full, but ultimately, if you pour water into it, you know, more than half that volume is still unfilled. And that's sort of my metaphor for regulation at the moment, is that we have this regulation that that is designed for these large stones, and we want to fill that jar now with smaller stones, even with, you know, with sand, so that we actually fill the whole jar or connect everyone. But in order to do that, you know, transparency is essential. So we need transparency on the existence of, on where fiber networks are and where the points of presence are, what are the terms of access, because if you're a small operator, that's a way of seeing opportunity, right? If you
right.
see there's fiber running to your to your town, then suddenly, you know, to become a local service provider or to build a municipal network or a community network, that is the map that is going to demonstrate to you that there's an opportunity. And that's true everywhere. It's not South Africa in particular, but, you know, finding out where fiber networks are is finding out, you know, is it feasible to actually build, you know, a data network here. I think why towers are important is because we need better data on coverage, right? Right now, if you want to know whether everyone is covered by a mobile network signal, we rely on reports from the mobile network operators, which have been, you know, useful in terms of targeting or understanding general growth, but sometimes they're overstated. You know, what is the range of an 1800 megahertz tower? You know, and you might, you know, be a little optimistic in terms of its coverage. I think we've all seen places where, you know, the mobile network map says this coverage, but we don't get coverage. So the best way to actually really interrogate that issue is to have access to where all the towers are and what kind of equipment is on those towers. And, you know, that's not such a radical idea. There are, a number of regimes where publishing that data is actually a norm. And then finally, spectrum, you know, if we're going to talk about, you know, how to, you know, a network like Zenzeleni in the Eastern Cape can deliver services there, if we don't actually have transparency on what the spectrum assignments are, and often there's little tiny chunks of spectrum that, you know, the regulator hasn't considered as a possibility for access, but for a small operator like Zenzeleni, you know, that could be extremely valuable. So more transparency around spectrum assignments is kind of fundamental to having the kind of public debate about how do we actually, you know, drive access into the little, you know, the areas that are, may be considered as serviced but aren't actually served.
Right. And should it be ICASA, the regulator, that's driving this?
Well, I think, you know, from an operator perspective, it's really in their interest to be, you know, more forthcoming about their infrastructure. So, you know, Airtel in India, they publish, all of their towers on their website, and, you know, their slogan is kind of, you know, because we have nothing to hide. you get fiber operators like DFA that, you know, that publish every, you know, right down to the sort of curbside of their fiber network, and because they're proud of it, you know. It's, why yeah. wouldn't you, you yeah. know, publish that information? I think on spectrum, it's more of a kind of, it's a regulatory issue that you, you just want to make all of those transactions, because millions of dollars are changing hands now for spectrum. We just want a completely clean, transparent process where it's well understood by anyone who wants to know exactly what the assignments are and on what terms. I mean, but you know, ideally, it would just be a matter of public policy, you know, where, you know, in the same way that, you know, we embrace open data on other, you know, on transport infrastructure, for instance, you know, we would just simply extend the same idea to telecoms. I just think it's gonna lead to better outcomes.
You have done some work in this regard. I forget the details. I think you may have worked with someone else on it to map terrestrial fiber links across Africa. Are you still maintaining that that map, and how comprehensive is it today?
I started that map about 5 or 6 years ago now, and it's now supported by the Network Startup Resource Center, which is based at the University of Oregon, with whom I have an association. And I sort of assumed when I started building it that it would just be like a kind of crowdsourced approach. I just put the word out, and then everyone would contribute their maps, and we'd have this fantastic map of fiber infrastructure. And I was dead wrong. Mm. I mean, I think I can count the number of people who've contributed maps to, you know, spontaneously contributed maps to that map on one hand, or not much more. And, you know, a lot of those maps that have gone into making that overall map, you know, have been kind of begged, borrowed, or, you know, stolen in order to create that map, because operators are very reluctant in many cases to reveal that, not for any good reason that I can detect, but that reluctance exists. And so part of the move towards, you know, campaigning for open data is it's just too hard. It's too hard to, you know, to sort of try and, you know, beg and borrow those maps to put together that after fiber map. And so, you know, it became evident to me after a few years that, you know, I needed a new plan because this one wasn't working. And so in terms of accuracy, I'd say, you know, it's about 70% accurate. There's actually a lot more fiber than I'm representing on that map, but, you know, getting access to it.
All right. What's the URL if people want to go and have a look at that map?
So it's after African Terrestrial Fiber, so afterfiber.nsrc.org.
Great. Go and have a look at that. And, of course, your undersea cable map is available on manypossibilities.net. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. I haven't quite figured out what to do with that map now. That I mean, it's actually just gotten too crowded, and I have to think of a new way of representing all these undersea cables, because it's just now, you know, which is a good problem to have, but it's not one I would have predicted.
Indeed, indeed. Steve, before I let you go today, let's, and I'm probably leaving the biggest thing to last here, but let's talk a bit about network neutrality. I must say I'm a bit divided on the issue of net neutrality. The more I read about it, the more convinced I'm becoming that it is a bad idea that could, like many regulations, have unintended consequences and potentially negative consequences for competition and for consumers. So I'm hoping to have a little bit of a debate in the closing minutes of our podcast recording today. You correct me if I'm wrong, but you are dead against the Trump administration's decision through the Federal Communications Commission to roll back the Obama-era net neutrality rules. What in your view, or why in your view rather, is net neutrality important?
Well, network neutrality is important from my point of view, from the point of view of the sharing of information and the creation of value on the internet. So we don't want any, I mean, I don't think you want any kind of mechanism that allows for the throttling of certain types of information, because that could end up playing out negatively for groups that are struggling for freedom of expression. But perhaps more importantly is that, you know, you never know where the next sort of phenomenon is going to come from on the internet. You know, I mean, who would have predicted Netflix? Who would have predicted WhatsApp? I mean, I'm sure many people did, but I didn't. I mean, I sort of missed the boat on a number of technologies. And so we want, you know, I think a regulatory regime that ensures that we have a kind of level playing field where the next juggernaut isn't sort of prematurely throttled by an environment that favors one of the sort of existing big players. And I think we have that problem on different levels now. And I also think it's playing out differently in the U.S. than it is, say, in sub-Saharan Africa. And I think it's unfortunate that, you know, that the network neutrality debate is interpreted, you know, in the kind of U.S. framework and then applied globally, which I think, you know, it isn't the most helpful outcome, because the U.S. is a very specific market that has very specific constraints, and which are you know, in many ways very different from say South Africa. So, in terms of how you apply the rules, you know, I think, you know, it's good to have a more nuanced discussion.
How do you? I mean, certainly the white paper that the government produced, the South African government produced, on telecommunications, has taken quite a hard line stance on net neutrality. They're proposing implementing it quite robustly in the South African context. We're not sure yet in which legislation they're going to do this. It certainly hasn't appeared in the Electronic Communications Amendment Bill. But if net neutrality rules were to be applied in the South African context, what should they be saying?
For me, they would say that we want innovation to thrive in South Africa, and we believe that that applying neutrality to the internet is fundamental to making sure that the next Mark Zuckerberg, Steve Jobs, could come from anywhere in South Africa. And in order to do that, though, I think you have to ensure that that small ideas are allowed to grow into big ideas. So for me, in South Africa, app specific zero rating is as big a problem as anything else, right? If we talk about how would a messaging app that addressed very specific South African issues thrive in South Africa when WhatsApp is zero rated and Free Basics is zero rated? I mean, how is that going to be good for the development of South African apps? I also think there is a big danger that is under discussed is the issue of defaults, right? If we create defaults for people in terms of using things, that can entrench behavior and make it difficult for competition to thrive. So the fact that when my airtime runs out on Vodacom, it asks me, would I like to use Facebook instead? I mean, that doesn't seem like a healthy default to me. I think, which brings us back to the issue of universal basic internet. I think the network neutrality debate is often oversimplified because everybody throttles traffic. Let's face it. All network operators manage their internet services. I think the key thing though is we want to push that management of access as close to the edge of the network as possible. As a kind of general principle, which then allows consumers to choose, right? They can choose a service that says, look, we actually, prioritize your voice traffic but if it's being done at the edge of the network, then you have consumer choice and competition and people can select the services they want. When network neutrality is being violated near the cores of the network, or the intermediary parts of the internet, then it's much more pervasive, much more problematic for a couple of reasons. One, its impact is more pervasive, right, in that it affects, a whole segment of the market as opposed to just very specific aspects of it, but also it's often invisible, and that's one of the key things that we saw in North America is that it was partly that the big operators were throttling traffic, but also that they were lying about it. They were denying the fact that they were doing it, and it's very, very difficult to actually prove. So, stifling that kind of violation of network neutrality, I think, is really fundamental. But I think we always have to bring it back to sort of basic principles. What do we want? Well, we want free and fair access. Right? We want everyone to access the internet on equal terms, and we want the ability to innovate services on equal terms. And constantly kind of checking against those principles is important, as it's a changing it's a changing environment. With new technologies, new access technologies. I think in some ways it's more optimistic in South Africa than it is in North America, because in North America you get this kind of entrenched duopoly between the cable operators and the the telcos, and I think there's some crazy interesting stuff going on in South Africa now with fiber, and there's like 35 fiber network operators.
Yeah.
This is bananas. I mean, I just love what has happened. You know, starting in Parkhurst now, but with communities kind of, you know, self-organizing and self-deploying fiber. It is arguably, from a fiber perspective, South Africa is one of the most interesting places in the world.
I was going to ask you, Steve, surely in a properly functioning, fully competitive market, which perhaps South Africa's industry is on the fixed line fiber side now, you don't need net neutrality rules because the consumer is in charge. And if one ISP says, well, actually, we're going to throttle your Netflix or not provide you with a service or access to this particular service, you as a consumer can simply switch to another ISP.
So the best, you know, the best solution for network neutrality is more, you know, more network, because then, you know, when there's more network, any attempt to throttle is simply, you know, solved from a competition point of view. And that's the ideal outcome.
Yeah.
I think, you know, the desirable outcome. At the same time, you're still going to find niches where it's not going to be a kind of, you know, relatively wealthy suburb of Johannesburg. But as you go out into more marginal areas, where that choice isn't going to exist, and from that point of view, having network neutrality principles baked into to policy is not a bad thing from my perspective.
And I suppose in a rural area, your choices are quite limited in that you're probably connecting to the mobile network, and there may only be one or two signals available to you. So the choice is much more limited. I think my worries, Steve, and maybe you can comment on this. I think my worries around network neutrality is that it could actually harm innovation. I know it's meant to allow innovation to thrive, but what, for example, if a strong net neutrality regime is introduced, as the South African government is proposing in the white paper? What does it mean if I'm an ISP, for example, and I want to prevent you as a customer from accessing peer-to-peer networks, which we all know are very bandwidth intensive, and you as a customer are happy with that arrangement because you don't need access to peer-to-peer networks? In a strong network neutrality environment, are you not creating a situation where an ISP no longer has the choice about whether or not they will provide access to peer-to-peer protocols? And if that is the case, are you not actually undermining innovation on the ability for an ISP to offer you a tailored package that might be less costly than it would otherwise be?
Yeah, it's a very interesting point. I mean, I lived through that period in living in Cape Town, from 2008, when, you know, in 2009, the first arrival of the undersea cables, and we began to see the sort of packages that ISPs were offering. You know, they were offering kind of shaped and unshaped,
yeah,
which is, a kind of euphemism for the access. And there were virtually no unshaped packages early on because the cost of international transit was still quite expensive. And, you know, as a consumer, I was just happy to have the internet, you know, and I could live without the BitTorrenting. So, you know, I couldn't complain. I was just thrilled to pieces that you know, high speed internet was there. So, I mean, I and I've written about this. I mean, that is a reality that is different for African countries than it is for North America, which is sort of, you know, closer to the heart of the internet. If you have to pay for expensive international transit, inevitably there are going to be hard decisions in terms of delivering access. A lot of startups that are trying to deliver content to rural access are sort of, you know, shaping and throttling content to try and deliver value to those specific communities. Those are hard arguments to argue against. I think that You know, my response to that would be to say that that where there is consumer choice, then there should be the opportunity to shape services to suit your to suit different aspects of the market. But in areas where there isn't consumer choice, I think that becomes problematic. Because it can lead to unpredictable outcomes. You can see I'm a little bit conflicted on the issue, and I'm sure my colleagues from Mozilla would cheerfully shoot me now for not being clearer on the message. But I think it's complicated. And we try to simplify the net neutrality message in order to get it over as a policy issue, and it's a big deal in the U.S. Trying to mobilize public opinion to change that, you've got to sort of, strip down the issue to its very simplest parts. But network neutrality is not simple. It's complicated once you peel back the layers. So I think, it's something that we want to aspire to the principles of network neutrality, and how that's implemented is something that we want to, that needs review. And I think the South African answer to it is not necessarily the same as the U.S. answer to it.
Yeah, and we're just starting to look at it here. I think there's still plenty of discussion to happen in the South African context. It's not even something I think that's been covered particularly much in the media in South Africa, whereas in the U.S. I think it's almost become an election issue, right?
Yeah, and for me, I mean, the zero rating of apps is the most problematic issue for me. If I were to get upset about anything, I would say, that the fact that the network operators can zero rate specific Silicon Valley companies, and offer that services, that's a big violation of the principles of network neutrality. That, when I think about, you will never see a South African Mixit ever again. If WhatsApp or Telegram or WeChat is zero rated, and it might not be a messaging, it might be something else. But if we're going to defend that level of innovation, having those kind of Silicon Valley defaults to be free just seems to me to be a real stifler.
Yeah, and we're seeing it more and more. Of course, Telkom's got its new lit plans, which zero rate access to services like video streaming services like Netflix and Apple Music on the audio side, Google Play Music, other services. So it is a growing phenomenon in South Africa. Just before I let you go, though, Steve, do you think that the regulator here should outlaw zero rating?
My obvious response to that would be to say that I think the regulator should push very hard for universal basic internet, because I think it does address this issue of affordability. And so I think universal basic internet is the solution to that. It's not the solution to streaming services and, the fact that, Cell C is zero rating its Black service. I mean, that is a bigger kettle of fish. The phenomenon of OTT streaming services may require its own kind of set of regulations. Yeah. And I think you have to treat the two of them somewhat differently because they're at the two ends of the spectrum.
Absolutely. Steve, we could talk all day on these subjects, but we should probably draw a line in the sand at some point. Let's wrap it up there. It's been a really great discussion, and thank you so much for taking the time to talk to Tech Central today. And hopefully next time you're in Joburg, I'll be up for a beer with you.
Duncan, it's a pleasure, and I really appreciate the opportunity to chat.